It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Suspected Boko Haram militants have attacked a village in northeastern Nigeria, killing at least 68 people. Witnesses tell VOA the militants attacked the community of Njaba in Borno State before dawn on Tuesday. Word of the attack took 2 days to reach the state capital Maiduguri, about 100 kilometers away, because of the remoteness of the area. The UN envoy for Libya says he believes a peace deal is possible between warring factions in Libya. Bernardino León and UN mediators met separately in Morocco Thursday with delegates from the Libyan government and with Islamic extremists who have taken over the capital, Tripoli, and set up a separate administration. UN officials hope to get the two rival governments talking to each other. The top military commander of Syria's al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front was killed. Abu Human al-Shami died along with several other Nusra Front members Thursday in an attack apparently targeting a high-level meeting. State-run Syrian media report the government forces carried out the strike against the militants in Idlib province. U.S. law enforcement officials are warning police and the public to be vigilant against attempts by Islamic State to recruit would-be terrorists through the Internet. The Washington Post reported the FBI arrested a 17-year-old student in a Washington suburb for allegedly using the Internet to help a young adult make his way to Syria to join Islamic State. Iraqi defense officials say they have cut off supply routes to Islamic State fighters in the city of Tikrit. IS militants have set fire to oil-filled trenches to stop the government advance. The battle for the town entered its fourth day Thursday. This is VOA News. The UN top human rights official is warning the fight against terror must not be used as an excuse to undermine democracy and human rights. Lisa Schlein reports.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein, warns that an overreaction to extremist violence threatens to erode the system for global security, which states built 70 years ago to ward off the horror of war. He says counter-terrorist operations that are disproportionate and brutal violate democratic norms and risk handing the terrorists a propaganda tool. In his speech, the High Commissioner cites a range of violations committed by terrorist groups, notably the Islamic State known as ISIS or ISIL, and the Nigerian Boko Haram militants. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. ambassador to South Korea says he is doing well and in great spirits after an assailant in Seoul slashed him on the face and wrist with a knife. Ambassador Mark Lippert was treated at a hospital with doctors needing 80 stitches to close an 11-centimeter gash on his face and surgery to repair damage to tendons and nerves in his arm. The attack happened as Ambassador Lippert attended a forum on Korean reconciliation. Police identified the assailant as 55-year-old Kim Ki-jung. South Korean media report Kim is a longtime anti-U.S. activist. A survivor of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings testified Thursday at a Boston courthouse in the trial of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. Race spectator Jeff Bauman described the moments after the attack as pure carnage. Bauman lost both legs in the explosions. Robert Bloom is a law professor observing the trial.
The government is going to portray Mr. Tsarnaev as a terrorist, someone who wanted to do great harm to people and to, in particular, to the United States of America.
Defense lawyers hope to convince the jury not to sentence Dzhokhar Tsarnaev to death by blaming his older brother as the mastermind. Three people were killed and more than 260 were injured in the bombing. American film star Harrison Ford was injured Thursday when a single-engine vintage airplane crashed on a golf course shortly after taking off from an airport in Santa Monica, California. Officials say the 72-year-old actor was breathing and conscious when he was taken to a nearby hospital, where he is listed in fair to moderate condition. Ford is the only person on board the aircraft. The cause of the accident is unknown. And the most prominent touring circus in the U.S., the Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus, says that by 2018, it will end its central display of Asian elephants, bowing to growing public concern about how the giant animals are treated. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA. Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, March 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian opposition parties threaten to boycott elections over voter card reader.
We find this threat very, very curious because we had an arrangement, in fact, an agreement with all the political parties that the card reader is going to be deployed to accredit voters on election day.
Nick Dazan is the Deputy Director for Public Affairs of Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission. Fuel shortages in Nigeria could impact the economy and the March 28 election. A milestone in Liberia as the last Ebola patient was discharged on Thursday, and yet another stalemate in South Sudan's peace talks in Addis Ababa.
The delegation from the rebel group are just walking out from their briefing. Dr. Riek Machar is surrounded by like 20 men and they are walking out of the venue. I don't know what they agreed on, but you can see the body language that nobody is happy.
That's reporter John Tanza of VOA's Sudan in Focus program, who is covering the talks in Addis Ababa. President Obama says targeted sanctions on Zimbabwe should continue. We'll get reaction from ZANU-PF. And women still lose out in the global workforce. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's opposition political parties have threatened to boycott the March 28 presidential vote if the Independent National Electoral Commission, known as INEC, continues with its plan to use voter card reader machines during the poll. INEC says the card reader are meant to help authenticate voters before they are allowed to vote. But the parties argue that the machine is prone to malfunction, which they say will disenfranchise prospective voters and undermine the credibility of the election. Nick Dazan, INEC's Deputy Director for Public Affairs, tells reporter Peter Clotty that officials of the electoral body are shocked at the stance of the opposition parties.
We find this threat very, very curious because we had an arrangement, in fact, an agreement with all the political parties that the card reader is going to be deployed to accredit voters on election day. We also had an agreement with them that except a voter on election day presents himself with a permanent voter card, he will not be allowed to vote in the election. And this particular agreement informed the guidelines for the elections, which we published in January. And before we published these guidelines, we circulated the guidelines to all the political parties for their inputs. And after they had made their inputs, we now published these guidelines and circulated them nationwide.
How is the Electoral Commission, in this case, how is INEC going to resolve this stalemate since they are threatening to boycott this election, which some people suggest could undermine the credibility of the vote if they put that to question about raising concerns about this card readers?
We do not see it as a stalemate as such, in the sense that we have demonstrated these same card readers to the members of the Senate. And they were very satisfied with the performance of the card readers. And we are confident, given the kinds of tests we had carried out before and mock elections that we had carried out using the card readers, that stakeholders in the process will see for themselves how these card readers work and how the card readers will add value to the electoral process. And how, in fact, at the end of the day, the same parties that are threatening to boycott the elections because of the card readers will be defeated in the court of public opinion.
How do you intend to resolve these concerns that they have?
Before the elections, we'll still engage with them. We have always engaged with them. Before the elections, we had a structured engagement with them after every quarter. Now, as the elections approach, we now increase the frequency of the engagement to once a month. And as the elections have even approached even closer, we engage with them on a nearly weekly basis. And as issues arise and concerns are voiced, we invite them and discuss with them. And certainly, we are going to do the same in respect of the card reader so that we assuage whatever anxieties that they might have.
Nick Dazan is the Deputy Director for Public Affairs of Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. Nigeria is suffering from a gasoline shortage as falling oil prices have affected the country's ability to import and distribute refined fuels. Coming just weeks before elections scheduled for March 28, the shortage could have a big impact on the campaign trail, as Henry Richwell reports.
In Abuja, the lines of cars waiting for gas are growing longer. Acute fuel shortages are gripping towns and cities across the country. Workers reliant on their cars are losing money fast, like taxi driver Bartholomew Ode Akpa.
I work at the airport as a car hire. Now, I'm supposed to be at the airport now, but there's no way for me, no fuel for me to go and look for something to do.
Nigeria is one of the world's top producers of crude oil and exports around 2 million barrels per day. But it doesn't have the refinery capacity to meet fuel demand, so it relies on imports. That makes the country vulnerable to a turbulent market, says Virginia Kamoli of the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Although Nigeria has tried over the past few years to diversify its economy, 80% of government revenues are still dependent on the oil industry.
The falling oil price has hit Nigeria's currency, the Naira, and traders say government fuel subsidies are not being paid. The CEO of the Seplat Petroleum Development Company, Austin Avuru, is calling on the government to boost domestic refining capacity.
Then you find out that the boom and bust elements of changes in crude oil prices will have much more negligible impact on our GDP growth than you have it today. And I think that's our countries should be moving in terms of how they manage their natural resources.
Nigerian Minister of Aviation Osita Benjamin Chidoka told VOA President Goodluck Jonathan is trying to reduce Nigeria's dependence on crude oil production.
One of our major foreign currency earners is oil, but it's also an opportunity for Nigeria. It creates an opportunity that luckily for us, our president has committed to improving agriculture over the past few years. Diversifying the economy, removing the subsidies that are kind of fueling a dependency culture.
The timing is difficult for President Goodluck Jonathan as he campaigns, trying to secure another 4 years in office. The elections have already been postponed once due to insecurity caused by the Boko Haram insurgency. It's not only Nigeria that is suffering, says Virginia Kamoli.
Other regional countries that export their goods into Nigeria, will suffer from a reduction in demand from the Nigerian market.
Analysts warn that continued low oil prices have the potential to cause unrest because the government will be forced to cut back on public spending. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Liberia on Thursday discharged its last confirmed Ebola patient from a treatment center in the capital, Monrovia. Talbo Nyesua, Liberia's Assistant Minister of Health for Preventive Services, described the day as a milestone. He said Liberia has gone 12 days without any new confirmed cases of the virus, but Nyesua said the country cannot and must not be complacent as it must now complete 42 days with no new cases reported set by the World Health Organization in order to be declared Ebola-free.
Yesterday, Thursday, was a very good day, a special day in Liberia. Since May 2014, we discharging the long confirmed pure Ebola case in the ETUs in Liberia. It means across Liberia, as of today, we do not have any confirmed Ebola case in our treatment unit. And so there's a lot of progress being made. But we know it is not over yet until it is over. So we've been telling our population to remain vigilant, to remain high alert, avoid complacency so that we can get to zero as a country.
When do you think, therefore, can Liberia claim to be Ebola-free?
According to protocol and the epidemiology of the disease, you have to go at least 2 incubation periods, which means 21 days of incubation period and additional 21 days. You need 42 days to go before you can be at least Ebola-free. And we have a long road to go yet because we've just gone 13 days. Our 21 days in County La Mosorado with the largest population will be March 13. And then if we can go additional 21 days, 42 days, then we can be hopeful that, yes, Liberia has no transmission of Ebola virus disease in the country.
But also we are at risk because bordering towns, Lola in Grand Theater, is still reporting fresh Ebola cases close to Yekepa in Nima County. And this is why Liberia has launched phase three in the eradication and elimination process of the EBD.
What does that mean when you say phase three?
Phase three means it's now time that we remain deepening community engagement. Liberians at this time need to be very, very careful and abide by all of the preventive measures that the Ministry of Health of Liberia have issued to the public that we've been adhering to, of which today we've gone 13 days without a case. It also means increase our surveillance system and getting suspected cases from all of our counties and testing them in our laboratories to ensure that there is no Ebola around in the communities anywhere.
Talbin Yeswa is Liberia's Assistant Minister of Health for Preventive Services. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Friday, March 6. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. The latest round of peace talks between the two warring parties in South Sudan has come to a standstill as President Salva Kiir and his rival, former Vice President Riek Machar, failed to agree on any of the major outstanding issues. The East African regional group, known as IGA, which is mediating the talks in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, has set a Thursday deadline for the two sides to iron out their differences. In a brief statement on Thursday, IGA said the two leaders will continue negotiations today, Friday. Earlier yesterday, John Tanza of VOA Sudan in Focus program, who is covering the talks, described some of the issues of disagreement.
The chief mediator, Ambassador Seyoum Mesfin, briefed the press and told the journalists around that the two parties could not agree on the outstanding issues that they have been, you know, disagreeing on for 2 weeks. He told the press that he hopes that they will agree tomorrow and hopefully a deal will be signed. So when he was asked, is this the end of the talks, he said, no, mediation does not end in a day. It's a continuous process. And IGA is not letting off the two parties to go back and resume what they are good at doing.
We've heard criticism that too much time has been wasted on talking about a power-sharing deal and reintegrating the two armies into one, and not enough time on the real problems facing South Sudan. How do the two sides react to that criticism, John?
Well, the two sides are saying that that outsiders don't know the issues in South Sudan, and most of them want a quick fix. And delegates from the two parties are saying the issues that they have been disagreeing on are the issues that led to this violence in South Sudan. Yes, indeed, there are people who are saying too much time has been wasted on who wants which position and who wants to be appointed where. But the two delegates are saying addressing the issues of governance will bring an everlasting peace in South Sudan.
Right, but if the both sides are not budging from their points of their frame of mind on governance, how is a peace deal going to be reached?
Well, if you speak to the rebels, they will tell you they are serious about finding an everlasting solution to this problem. And the government also will tell you that they are serious in finding an everlasting solution to this problem. And so they do not want to be told that they are wasting time.
Considering that, you know, we only have a few hours left, what is, you know, the general mood there right now?
There's nobody at the venue of the talks right now here. You can only see a battery of journalists, each one glued to their laptop or computers, trying to file their stories back to their stations. But the delegation from the rebel group are just walking out from their briefing. I can see them walking in a group. Dr. Riek Machar is surrounded by like 20 men, and they are walking out of the venue. I don't know what they agreed on, but you can see the body language that nobody is happy.
That was John Tanza of VOA Sudan in Focus program speaking earlier Thursday from Addis Ababa with Carol Van Dam in Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama said that targeted sanctions on Zimbabwe should continue. In a notice issued Wednesday this week, President Obama cited unusual and extraordinary threat to the foreign policy of the United States by named members of the government of Zimbabwe, who include President Robert Mugabe, ZANU-PF Deputy Director of Information and Publicity, Psychology Maziwisa, tells Umdemiaki Mwakalele of VOA Zimbabwe service that the continuation of the sanctions is nonsensical.
It's absolute and complete hogwash. If anybody poses any threat to anybody, it's the government of America. They've imposed sanctions that have caused enormous damage to our economy, and that is a serious threat to the livelihoods of the ordinary people of Zimbabwe. And we've seen this kind of destruction taking place over a protracted period of time. And, of course, we all know why they're imposing these sanctions. They would like government of President Robert Mugabe to be overthrown from power. And we are saying that's not the way of doing things in the 21st century. The entitlement to remove people from power or to elect leaders, especially in Zimbabwe, lies with the people of Zimbabwe.
Now, what do you think it will take on the part of ZANU-PF, on the part of President Mugabe directly, to help change the perspective that that the United States continues to hold on Zimbabwe?
Firstly, these sanctions have not worked in any way because President Mugabe has insisted that he will not compromise the empowerment policies which, you know, brought about these sanctions in any event. When we embarked on the land reform program, we all saw the punitive measures being imposed on Zimbabwe unlawfully, unjustifiably. But President Mugabe has not changed and is not going to change. If anybody needs to change, it is the American government. The entire Western world is in agreement that these sanctions have failed, and that's why the European Union a few weeks ago reached out to the government of Zimbabwe to say, we want really to normalize relations with you.
Psychologist Maziwisa is the Deputy Director of Information and Publicity for ZANU-PF. He was speaking to Undimiaki Mwakalele of VOA Zimbabwe Service. A new study shows during the past two decades, there has been little progress in women's participation in labor market and in narrowing the gender wage gap. On the eve of International Women's Day, the International Labour Organization reports women continue to suffer from widespread discrimination and inequality in the workplace. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The International Labour Organization says women are marginally better off now than they were 20 years ago when a far-reaching agenda for advancing gender equality and women's empowerment was adopted in Beijing. The agency reports women in most parts of the world remain undervalued. It says they are stuck in low-paid jobs, lack access to education, and have limited bargaining and decision-making power. It says most unpaid work falls on the shoulders of women, who are mainly responsible for caring for the family, the elderly, and the sick. The report notes more women than ever are working. Nevertheless, it says the gap in labor market participation rates between men and women has decreased by only 1%. ILO economists estimate reducing this gap by 25% in earn less than women without children, depending on where they live and how many children they have. But other studies show that fathers earn more than men who do not have children. Olney tells VOA discrimination against women in the workplace harms the social and economic well-being of society.
Economies that have gender gaps in the labor market suffer from a GDP loss of up to 27% in certain regions. We see that initial findings that increased female labor participation could substantially reduce poverty.
Another issue of great concern is violence in the workplace. The ILO says some 35% of all women are victims of physical and or sexual violence that affects their attendance at work. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the Africa Junior Athletics Championships in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Morocco's Mushin Kaoua won the men's long jump with a leap of 7.45 meters to clinch the first championship gold medal on Thursday. South Africa's Leandre Gale won the women's discus with a throw of 46.76 meters. Medina Beriso and Suru Bulo secured a 1-2 Ethiopian triumph in the women's 3,000 meters, while Kenyan Abraham Kibiwot clocked 8 minutes and 47.4 seconds to triumph in the men's 3,000-meter steeplechase. Staying in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia has taken an early lead on the medal table with 1 gold, 2 silver, and 1 bronze medal. Kenya is second, while Morocco and South Africa share third spot. They are followed by Egypt, Nigeria, and Algeria. Action resumes at the championship today, Friday. Meanwhile, Kenya's two-time world marathon champion Abel Kirui and 2005 women's world cross-country silver medalist Alice Timbilil headlined the second edition of the First Ladies Half Marathon in the Kenyan capital Nairobi on Sunday. The race is a brainchild of the Kenya's First Lady Margaret Kenyatta and is part of the Beyond Zero campaign, which is aimed at raising funds to reduce maternal death and infant mortality through improved health care countrywide. In cricket, South Africa play Pakistan in Auckland, New Zealand, as Zimbabwe face Ireland in Hobart, Tasmania Island in Australia at the ICC Cricket World Cup tomorrow, Saturday. In football, hosts Senegal play Nigeria before Republic of Congo engage Ivory Coast in Group A action at the start of the Africa Under-20 Championships in Dakar on Sunday. In cycling, Africa's top cyclists compete at the UCI Africa Tour Series starting in the Algerian capital Algiers on Sunday. For the rest of the month, they will also compete in Annaba, Blida, Constantine, and Oran. Finally, in handball, Africa Zone 5 men's and women's 2015 All-Africa Games handball qualifiers get underway in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia on Sunday. The contest features Burundi, Egypt, Kenya, Rwanda, Sudan, Uganda, and hosts Ethiopia. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend, and we look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, March 6.
Hello, Africa. Good morning. I'm a European citizen. Yesterday, the 2nd of March, I heard from the Belgian people coming from the National Border Response Center, Australia, of $17 million infection all over the country. While over in Liberia, we have gone now for 5 days of no new infection. So I'm calling all my fellow Australians, young and old, not to be complacent and do the right thing that the healthcare workers are telling us to do. Let's stop washing dead bodies, stop touching sick people. Together we can defeat Ebola. Again, it's in the show from Freetown, Australia.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And that's it for this Friday, March 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark O'Woman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Hello, I'm Douglas Mboga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests that share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.